They would change a little bit of the configuration.
Called meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We probably will have some members and some members of the audience dribbling in after they discover that we are not meeting in room 200 today. But we do have a quorum, and we have a lot of business to conduct. One of the items of business that I neglected to see to at the last meeting because of the time constraints was the approval of the minutes from January 17th and February 4th, and now, of course, we have minutes from February 13th as well. So, one at a time, Representative Rood, since you were one of the people that actually attended the meeting on January 17th, would you move the minutes from that meeting?
I make that motion. Move the minutes from the 17th. Sorry?
That's correct. Any additions or corrections? All those in favor of the adoption of the minutes from January 17th, signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Those minutes are adopted. February 4th. Representative Beard, if you would be so kind as to...
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the minutes of the February 4th committee meeting.
Thank you. That motion has been made. All those in... are there any additions and corrections to the minutes from February 4th? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Those are adopted. And February 13th. Representative Bly. Moves the adoption of the minutes from February 13th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. The first order of business now is to deal with the recommendations of this committee to the Capital Investment Committee. We only had three bills with bonding proposals in them, which, of course, we heard as best we could last week. And at that time, members will recall, I asked you to submit individually your recommendations for those bills. It's a somewhat different process than we have been accustomed to in the past with the what leadership and the Capital Investment Committee has asked for is recommendations from the committees in actual bill form. So what we actually have before us at this point, members, is just a bill that we have in our possession from last session, which is House File 1392, which actually in one form was included in the Omnibus Finance Bill. But the bill itself is still in the possession of the committee. We were planning on using that as a vehicle for the recommendations of capital investment. And to that end, the chair would move House File 1392 to be before the committee. And the next motion, members, would be That House File 1392 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Capital Investment Division. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The chair then would move DE 1 amendment. Members, what this accomplishes is to delete the contents of the bill from last session and substitute the language of the three proposals that we heard and for which we are passing along our recommendation. I would note that in section 2 of the delete all amendment, the priorities as they were established by consensus or lack thereof in the proceedings of the February 13th meeting are included. What those recommendations were, and I have a tally sheet here, but if anyone is interested, of the three bills, according to the judgment of the committee, the Green Bonds Bill, Representative Canoes, House File 1951, was recommended to have the committee's highest priority. Representative Thiessen's bill, the Waste Energy Demonstration Project, was recommended to have a medium priority, and the Representative Norton's Streamline Extension Project was recommended to have a, of the three, the lowest priority. There were none that were recommended to not be funded at all. That is, by consensus, there were certainly some members that made that recommendation. I think about each of these bills, actually, but that is the breakdown of content of the amendment as it stands. And with that explanation, members, I would renew my motion that we adopt the H1392DE1 amendment. Any discussion? I should mention that if we adopt this amendment, then I believe we have four amendments to the DE1 that will be before us. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the adoption of the 1392DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. It is before us, and we do, as I said, have amendments to the amendment. Representative Noose, I believe, you have the A31 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A31 amendment. Basically, what this does is requires the municipalities, the local units of government, to look, to at least contact our utility and see if the possibility of SWIP programs are there. And if they are there, then the grant program would not pay for those things that the SWIP program would pay for.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A31 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kalin, A32 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a verbal amendment to the A32 amendments that just puts it in cleaner form. If I could read it and then explain it.
Yes, and Representative Kalin, in the absence of Representative Kahn, who would be really like to point this out to you immediately, I would remind you that all amendments are verbal, and what you mean is an oral amendment.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was unsure of either, and I thought I would call it an orbal amendment, but I thought I would leap and make a mistake.
Whether it's orbal or not will be up to the committee to decide.
The A32 amendment should read as follows, page 4, line 25, after the period in section, a new sentence. I'll look to counsel for how he wanted to start the sentence, then I'll read it from there.
Here's my suggestion anyway. Page 4, line 25, after the period, insert. The definition may not allow major renovations to encompass less than 10,000 square feet. Do you want to take it from there?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after 10,000 square feet in the amendment, or to encompass less than the complete replacement of a mechanical, ventilation, or cooling system of the building or a section of the building, period.
Yeah, that must be all.
Yes.
And
Representative Kalin, you want to explain your amendment?
I will indeed, Mr. Chair. This merely provides a little bit of guidance to the departments, to admin and commerce, as well as those developing and maintaining the guidelines, to make sure that we're within the reasonable bounds of that it's not just a matter of a few hundred square feet and all this, changing carpet, and all of a sudden you have to update an entire building's energy performance, but I believe this is within the guidelines of the general best practices of the industry and of the design community, that you replace the guts of the building, that's your opportunity to upgrade, and 10,000 square feet may not be the magic number, but we know that it's at least the minimum number, and they should not go below that. And I appreciate Representative Canoes working with us, and Representative Gunther as well, to find the right magic bullet here.
Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Canoes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do support this amendment.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A32 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gunther, A30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will withdraw my A30 amendment. Representative Kalin and I worked together, and we decided we were close enough to wanting the same things that we accommodated each other. I'm fine with the way it is.
Very good. Representative Gunther withdraws the A30 amendment. Representative Hackbarth, the A29 amendment.
You just amended that.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw that amendment.
Very well. Representative Hackbarth withdraws the A29 amendment. Are there any further amendments?
We talked about it.
Further discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1392 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Capital Investment Division. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed to the Finance Division, or the Finance Committee. With that, the moment we've all been waiting for, is it now Deputy Commissioner Garvey, or is it Director Garvey, or Deputy Commissioner Director Garvey? In any case, welcome to the committee, sir. Oh, I forgot Acting Reliability Administrator also.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey. I do have a series of titles. At least several of them are fit for print. One is Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Another is Director of the Office of Energy Security. And yes, as you mentioned, I am the Acting Reliability Administrator. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mike Bull is detained up at the Revisor's Office, so will be joining me in as soon as that is that task is completed. I will sort of be walking through a one-page outline, which I believe is in your packet, that's entitled sort of Update to the House Energy Finance and Policy Division. The first item on that agenda is the Office of Energy Security Organization and Budget. Mr. Chairman, you and the committee, I believe, already have a copy of, in your packet, the organizational chart of the office. The governor's executive order that he used to create it. A one-page overview of our budget, as well as, if you may, our sort of new letterhead logo of the office.
A virtual tabula rasa, Mr. Garvey.
It's a process for sure, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure exactly how to start, but I'll just work with the start off the organizational chart. In the executive order, the as you know, energy is an important part of Governor Pawlenty's overall leadership initiatives as the governor of the state, but also in his role as National Governors Association chair and that kind of thing. And he sort of concluded that the role of energy in his administration did not have the highlight nature that he felt it deserved. And so we thought of ways to give it that, and the conclusion was the best way to go about it was to create its own separate office within the Department of Commerce. That way we can now organize ourselves and label ourselves and publicize ourselves to the public that there is a specific spot where when you sort of Google energy or energy in Minnesota, that kind of thing, you'll be brought specifically to the website within our office. We chose the title Energy Security because we believe that when we talk about energy, we think about security both in pricing, both in availability, both in environmental superiority, and all those kind of things get wrapped up in the word security, and so we thought putting those two words together matched with his policies and the desires of the state. So we went ahead and the governor issued the executive order. The Office of Energy Security will encompass the three main areas currently of the division that I head up, the energy assistance, the energy planning and advocacy, that's our policy, and then the state energy office, which is our outreach and information office. I still will oversee the telecommunications functions and advocacy and policy portions that are within the Department of Commerce, and I'll be overseeing that in the capacity as deputy commissioner. You have before you a organizational chart that sort of identifies that we have roughly 75 total members within the office, and including the telecom folks. It's a office that is comprised of extraordinarily intelligent and competent and dedicated people that do an extraordinarily large amounts of work, and they do it very, very well. I am very proud to be able to work with them and serve with them on that. Mr. Chairman, that's sort of, I can walk through the budget, although I don't believe I kept a copy of
well,
one page. Yeah, oh, here it is. Mike, this is Mike Bull. He is Deputy Director of the Office of Energy Security and Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy and Advanced Technology. So we believe in sort of the titles for that kind of thing.
Well, Mr. Director, before we get into the budget questions, an organizational chart. I think this is probably reflective of the organization that has existed in your division of the Department of Commerce previously. Is that correct? And are there any changes here from how this has been organized up till a couple of weeks ago?
Mr. Chairman, there's a very dramatic and significant change.
Just right at the top of there?
Well, that too, sir. But the line to the left and down, that wasn't there before, sir. It used to be a line down, and that line that the energy assistance was extended over to telecom.
All right. Chris Garvey. I guess the question would be, given sort of a redefined focus for what now is the Office of Energy Security, do you contemplate any changes in your organization or any additions or alterations to the functions that are described here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the most significant important rationale for the creation of the Office of Energy Security was to highlight and make more readily available to the public, to Minnesotans at large, where they can go within state government to gather information for energy information, energy services, who regulates who and while in the, how in the energy field. So to the extent we renamed that and we now have our own separate logo, we'll have our own separate website, we figure that's a very significant operational impact. The other part of the governor's executive order is that he wanted to make sort of clear that within the administration, while the issue of climate change cuts across nearly every state agency, that there was a focal point for those issues, and that focal point is in the director of this Office of Energy Security. So those are the two significant changes that will come out of this order. One is the public communication and public appearance. The other is the focal point for climate change issues. Other than that, my folks will be continue to operate as they have in the past.
Well, Mr. Garvey, just one brief question. Is the website to which you refer up and running, is it in a redeveloped form, or when should we anticipate that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the website that we are in the process of constructing, and these things always take longer than you sort of hope, but we are in the process of putting that up, and all I can say is we want to get that up as quickly as humanly possible.
Mr. Garvey, that was since the focus, at least according to the title of the office, is on security. I think in the past what we have seen with the function of your division within the Department of Commerce has been to a large degree regulatory, oversight of various entities to a very large degree generators of electricity. When we're talking about energy security, I think we need to be looking somewhat beyond that. I'm thinking of one of the things that came up in our January 17th hearing that we held jointly with the local government committee, and which due to the unfortunate coincidence of the governor's press release, we weren't able to attend that meeting. But had you been there, one of the things that you would have heard was a circumstance described by one of the presenters about what happened as a result of Hurricane Katrina in the state of South Carolina. One of the things that happened in Katrina was that a major pipeline running from New Orleans to the East Coast was disrupted. It had to be shut down. And that resulted in a sort of immediate fuel crisis in South Carolina, for which there was virtually no gasoline available at service stations throughout the state. And what happened then was that local units of government concerned about fueling their emergency vehicles, police cars, fire trucks, ambulances, etc., went to the state officials and asked them to share with local units of government their strategic petroleum reserve, gasoline reserve, which the state said, well, we can't do that. We have this in reserve for use of state vehicles, but we don't really have enough to share, which kind of got local units of government in South Carolina thinking about what they needed to do to achieve any measure of security in certain circumstances. And it caused me to wonder if we had even such a limited reserve in Minnesota, and to my knowledge, we don't. Not even at the state level, much less anything that's capable of being shared with local units of government that might need it. And I'm just wondering if in your future plans you contemplate addressing issues like this regarding our security, or if you're planning just continuing to monitor what the electric generation sector is doing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the petroleum reserve concept that you discussed is an interesting one that's certainly worth considering. In addition, the director, pursuant to statutes that are actually several decades old, has the legal authority to impose restrictions on use of fuels and allocate who can use fuels so that those kinds of instances can be addressed in a situation of dire need.
I'm wondering how you perceive over the relationship between the Office of Energy Security and our Office of, or whatever, however that's described, our emergency planning agencies in the state.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Department of Homeland Security is the state's, under the, working with and under the direction of the governor, is our primary response department for all instances of tragedy and or we'll call it bad events. The working with them, all of the remaining other state agencies have a support role. As Deputy Commissioner, as Commissioner of Commerce, and more specifically now as Director of the Department of Energy Security, I am part of those supporting roles that in my staff. I am in the process of being certified for National Incident Management Systems Evaluations and those kinds of things. I mean, we are in the process of making sure that we all sort of can align ourselves and work with the Department of Homeland Security, because they are the point for. Beyond that, as you move beyond the initial response to an incident, then you go into the policy issues of what individual state agencies could do. And this is where we were working and looking at some of the fuel supply and fuel allocation authorities that we had. Candidly, back when Katrina, while we did not have pipeline shortages here, we certainly did have some supply questions here. That we were exploring what is our legal authority and what was our responsibility and how, and assessing whether or not it required our intervention at the time, and thankfully it did not.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some more questions down the road, but I wanted to comment, make a small correction and then a question to this issue of security and the local implications. Actually, the Homeland Security, or the State Emergency Operations Plan, has the local responding agency being the primary responder for the first 20 or 48 hours, and then sometimes longer, depending on the situation. And the Department of Homeland Security technically is a co-lead responder. But it highlights the point, I think, even more, that actually the first response does come on the local unit of government where the incident happens. That's good. I appreciate very much that you're taking the going down the road of the NIMS training, and I think it's very critical. I'm just wondering, we're going to hear a bill, I think, on Thursday in public safety that's been working with DPS and folks over at Homeland Security to require that every state agency that signed on the Emergency Operations Plan actually have somebody who is matriculating as fast as possible through that certification program, 256 hours of training. Is somebody at the Department of Commerce or at the Office of Energy Security, whoever is now formally signed on to the Emergency Operations Plan, is somebody fully trained and certified in that protocol, and who is the lead contact person? Is it the director, the deputy commissioner, the acting reliability administrator, or
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, members of the committee? Yes, you're certainly correct. The local responders are the primary, are initially the ones in charge. I was responding to what my role in interrelationship with at a state level. So I take my, I follow the lead, and my job is to support the Department of Homeland Security and their relationships with all first responders. As to your second question, I and a number of my colleagues within the Department of Commerce are in the process of being NIM certified. The question that we're then is asking is, beyond the understanding what our respective roles are and understanding the hierarchical nature and the responsibilities that go with that, is whether or not we need someone that is completely sort of emergency response. Because we're generally in a support role rather than in a outside of the incident role as regulators, and we're going to be answering that question: whether we need someone that's to be truly, fully immersed in part of the emergency incident scenarios and that kind of thing, or whether it's just better to make sure we know what our role is and we do what we're told from the Department of Homeland Security.
Further questions at this time? Mr. Gregory, you want to get into the budget then?
Mr. Chairman, the budget is there more for you and the committee's review. It sort of shows the sort of the allocation from the general fund and the various special revenues. Our budget people are not here today, so if you had specific detailed questions on the underlying categories, I may not be able to answer it. But I thought that since you are our finance committee as well as our policy committee, that you'd want to sort of see what the lay of the land is as of sort of late last week on our budget.
Any questions from members on budgetary issues?
Mr. Chairman, do you have questions? Should I just move on, sir?
We can always come back to this if we need to, so please proceed.
The next item on the agenda, at least the one that I've provided, is a very quick overview of the Midwest Governor Association Summit and Greenhouse Gas Accord. This is not meant to be a full briefing. It's more basically to make the committee aware that last November, the governor and the governors from the Midwest states, there are for 12 in total, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North and South Dakota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. They got together and we sort of identified under Governor Plenty and Governor Doyle, who's the chair of the Midwest Governor Association, to focus on energy and to develop a platform of energy security and climate stewardship for the Midwest. And last November, an accord was signed. 12 states, as well as Manitoba, sort of joined in the overall signing of a. Actually, Missouri didn't sign. Signing of the introduction preamble, and then there were three other tiers that each state sort of decided whether they wanted to sign on to or not. Tier two was a set of goals and objectives and policy options on energy efficiency, bio-based products and transportation, renewable electricity, and advanced coal with carbon capture and sequestration. Tier 3 was a set of regional initiatives, common signs, for example, ways of addressing commonalities by common purchasing among states, so we use the state as purchasing of renewable products and bio-based products. Those kinds of things. Then, of course, the Tier 4 was the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Reduction Accord, which basically symbolized and put in place a pathway for the governors from 5 states and the province of Manitoba, as well as several observers to start exploring a regional approach to addressing greenhouse gas emissions. We are now in the process. I'm talking about all of the states that are involved in their respective tiers to develop stakeholder groups to work with us and advise us on how to implement the various elements of the platform, as well as organizing our respective states to pursue the strategies and tactics needed to implement those actions. I'm sure in the coming weeks and months, I'll be back before you to give you the details of what those elements are.
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike Ball. I'm the Deputy Director for the Office of Energy Security. And I just want to make two quick points about this, the Midwest Governor's Platform. I try to put it a little bit in context. I wanted you folks to know that the commitment that the Midwest governors made, the regional commitments that we've made together toward 30% renewable electricity goals by 2025, 50% biofuel use by in that same time frame, huge commitments on improvements toward energy efficiency, and I think the list goes quite a bit on and on about what those commitments were, but I think it's important for you folks to know that that Minnesota really set the floor for the activity in the Midwest Governors Association. We came out of this session, last session, into the negotiations with the Midwest Governor states, and really we set the bar for that discussion with the work that we all did last session together. An important thing to know is that these 12 states, when taken together, would comprise the 7th or 8th largest emitter of greenhouse gas emitters in the world. And to get that kind of commitment from those states toward these kinds of things, I think it was a huge accomplishment, and due in a large part to the work that you did last session with. So I just wanted to make those two quick points on the NDA platform.
Thank you. Representative Askew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just was, in Minnesota, we care a lot about transparent government and representative government, and wondering the role of the legislature in moving forward on some of the initiatives with the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Accord. What you see as the role of the legislature.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Canute, members of the committee. The timetables and process for implementing the Midwest Governor's Greenhouse Accord is one where we're going to have a lot of stakeholders and a lot of discussions from a lot of folks throughout the Midwest, and candidly from the two coasts as well. In that setting, the individual governors will have a role in that. We as their staff and designated point people will have roles. The respective legislative bodies in the respective states will certainly have roles, as well as countless sets of stakeholders will have roles. I mean, this is a discussion that we're trying to all have, and there's going to be plenty of work and plenty of opportunity for a lot of folks to have a lot of input into this. Each of those in their respective perspectives, both as individuals and as representatives of their perspectives, as well as in their organizational functions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said everyone has their respective roles, which I understand that they have roles. I'm just trying to get a sense of this. Will you be coming back to the legislature with proposals? Do you have legislators? Do you plan to have legislators in your stakeholder groups and these countless sets of stakeholders? I mean, it's a lot of process and things happening, and we had this happen with the Climate Change Action Group this year, and a lot of people did a lot of work this summer, and I think we have some bills around it, but I haven't seen many bills coming out of the administration surrounding the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group process, and so I'm curious if you see any role for legislators in the development in some of these agreements and some of that background work, because I think there probably might be some who would be willing to help out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Canute, members of the committee. The conundrum that we have as we're trying to figure this one out process-wise is literally there will be thousands, if not millions, of people who have interest in this when you start thinking about the region, when you're thinking about all five states plus the province of Manitoba who are involved, as well as the members who are observers. At the same time, we need to make sure that we work through and develop a way that brings representative folks and stakeholders to the table. The path that we're working on is going to be the similar path that we worked to the summit. We ask stakeholders to give their input. The governors and the executive branches in the various states got together and worked those out. And the governors signed a summit on how to move forward. We're now going to probably follow that path and similarly. But clearly there are going to be roles for legislatures in all the states and individual legislators in all the states to have input and actions on work in the process and ultimately their implementation at their respective states. Each state are different in how they implement things and how they do things.
Well, just to follow that up, Commissioner, I think one reason that we have seen states taking these initiatives is that we all, or most of us at least, have hoped for some of these issues to be dealt with more vigorously at the federal level. And seeing that has not exactly been forthcoming, I think that we sort of understand that maybe the federal government needs a little push from some of the states doing this. Certainly we've seen that in the Western Coalition and in Reggie and now with the one that's proposed in the Midwest. And maybe there's an analogy here. Minnesota itself has provided kind of a prod and leadership for other states in a number of issues. And I wonder if you see any role for Minnesota just within this forming coalition to provide the same sort of leadership function and what that might be.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we completely agree with you that the best place for these kind of issues to be dealt with is at the federal level. That not being the case, Governor Pawlenty is sort of saying states have a role. We think we should do that on a regional basis. As Deputy Director Bull already indicated, much of what we have done in this state, working with you and your leadership and your authorship of legislation, really was a template for what we were able to work with Wisconsin and Governor Doyle's staff, and bringing that together with the other states of the region to put together the summit in general, and some renewables, biofuels, pushing forward on regional nature and regional approach to greenhouse gas emissions. Our intention is to continue to pursue that leadership, taking what we've learned in Minnesota and educate our neighboring and similarly located states here in the Midwest to move forward on greenhouse gas emissions, at the same time making sure that what we're doing is compatible with what is going to happen, hopefully, at the federal level.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. This is, a budget question or clarification. On the spreadsheet, it showed under the E85 pump grants, it showed that $1.5 million had been extended. That's for 2 years, am I correct? So that's 08. Is there still money available in 09? For that,
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornick, there is another $1.5 million available for 09.
Okay. Okay, that's all I needed to know.
Representative Nornick, I think some clarification needs to be made about that. I think the reason that the department is showing the money is expended is because it has been allocated to the American Lung Association that has the responsibility for actually making those grants. But as far as how much of that money has actually been granted, I think it's somewhere around $300,000. Is that correct, Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornick, something on that order, about 30 separate new sites have been are being implemented.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify.
Representative Nornick.
That there's still money available, I think that's a really a good investment. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornick, there's money available still in this year, as the Chair has pointed out, from the American Lung Association for E85 grants. So if you have constituents that are looking, that would be still an opportunity.
And Mr. Bull, in that regard, I think there's some question about whether pending action on part of the federal government with the Farm Bill in particular might render some of these programs redundant. Is that any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, if the I think the what you might be referring to is that there is some, there are, if there is a farm bill, there might be some E85 infrastructure money available early. How does that work on the federal level? It's allocated, but the question about whether or not money will be actually appropriated for those programs is completely up in the air. So even if the farm bill contains a program for E85 pumps, it's not likely that the money follows right with that. That has to be appropriated in a separate budget bill, is my understanding. There are other folks who probably understand that better than I do.
Well, I hope so. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Director Garvey. I have a couple of questions related to the Midwest Governors Association Summit and the Greenhouse Gas Accord discussion. Have you been directly involved in these discussions? Have you been at these meetings?
Commissioner Garvey,
Mr. Chairman, Reverend Wolf, members of the committee. I have been. Others have been within, there are several of us who the governor has asked to serve in involved in these. But yes, I have been personally involved in this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple of follow-up questions. With these discussions that are going on, and especially I'm looking at the Greenhouse Gas Accord discussions, and I'm thinking long-term, you know, we may have some new governors in 2 to 4 years, and if these discussions continue and we don't really have anything that comes back to the states to really hold the state's feet to the fire, then we may not ever really have anything with teeth that leads to any impact. So my question to you is, I know last year we took up the issue of looking at Lake Superior and taking water out of Lake Superior, and the states are supposed to be passing essentially legislation in their own states that would have teeth. Do you anticipate anything coming out of these discussions that it's actually going to come back to the state of Minnesota and to the other states where we have to pass it and all the states have to agree to it in order for something to move forward? Do you have any idea whatsoever what is actually going to come out of this that is substantial? Can you give the committee any insight into that question, please?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I understand, Mr. Chairman, that this is, and I've taken us into an area where we can spend a lot of time, and I appreciate it. I'll try to give a very quick answer. The resolution that the five governors and the premier from Manitoba signed as part of the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Reductions has a very aggressive and, well, tight timetable with a set of objectives. Well, within 30 months from last November, we come back with a
that the effective date of the accord. I mean, so there is a very significant interest among the states that signed on to it to move quickly and to make this real. In the meantime, we're pursuing federal overarching options in addition.
Representative Westrom.
Well, Chair, Mr. Bull, on the P85, the biofuel pump issues, if I recall, we had carved out some for biodiesel or blending pumps last year. Is there any progress on that, or do you know any updates on that? And a second follow-up for that is the federal government making some movement on blending pumps that you know of, making it legal or easier to install them legally and dispense different types of E85, or not E85, but ethanol runs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, on the first question, you're correct that the E85 Everywhere program did have a carve-out for biodiesel pumps of higher blends. We've allocated something on the order of $250,000, made that available for up to 20 such grants, but I don't believe that any yet has been awarded. But I think I'd have to get clarity on that from Mr. Gerlach at the American Lung Association. We've put together the package to sort of recruit the service stations and such on the biodiesel pump. So we're working on that. On the second question, the issue for the ethanol blending pumps, and for folks who aren't aware, these are the pumps where you can drive up and pick your blend, so to speak. These are primarily or exclusively for flex fuel vehicles, E85 vehicles, so you can drive up to these pumps and dial in 30% ethanol or 40% ethanol. And those pumps are legal and available for use for flex fuel vehicles. What runs afoul of the federal regulators is the use of these higher blends in regular cars. The blends haven't been approved for the higher percentages of ethanol. So that's where the issue is. We run afoul with the EPA for the blender pumps. We have a few in Minnesota now, out west, out in your area, although I'm geographically challenged. Ortonville and a couple other spots where you can drive up and dial in the blend level you're looking for. You can do that now in the state. And we've worked with the American Lung Association to make some portions of the E85 Everywhere grants available for folks who want to do a blender pump installation. We will help cover the cost of the E85 portion of that installation. So that allows the help cover some of the costs. They're much more expensive than a standard E85 pump.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative West.
Mr. Bull, do I understand the blending pumps, using them for biodiesel, is not actually contradictory to the EPA, but ethanol with various blends in non-fuel flex vehicles is, or are both of those fuels? And maybe you're not the right person to ask this question to, but this
is all we've got.
This narrow interpretation was brought to my attention recently, that biodiesel blending pumps actually could be sold or installed in any variation of biodiesel blend could be legally sold to any diesel vehicle. Are you familiar with that at all, or are they both needing federal change to be able to legally dispense to all vehicles.
Mr. Chair, well, Representative Westrom, you're correct that they are under different regulatory schemes. That the, for example, when you all passed the E20 legislation, that's all subject to EPA approval of that 20% ethanol fuel blend. Whereas if you this year you pass the B20 initiative that's being discussed in ag policy as we speak, that will not be subject to EPA approval. The biodiesel is treated differently under the federal Clean Air Act.
One follow-up then, Mr. Chair.
Western.
E85 everywhere grants, are some stations considering putting in the blending pumps even though they aren't fully usable right now, but anticipate that investment being better than replacing the E85 pump with a blending pump, or is the cost so significantly different that you're not seeing that happen?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I guess I'd put it that if a station owner is looking, I think they'll tell us that if they're looking to put in a blending pump, it's the third E85 flex fuel vehicle because that's what's legal. So they probably wouldn't tell us that they'd want to serve the population of cars that they aren't supposed to be serving. So.
And Mr. Bull, I presume that the Office of Energy Security is planning on having someone on hand to make sure that no one drives up to those pumps that isn't legally authorized to do so.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, what we've done is the same as we've done with the E85 pumps, is to make sure that they are labeled for flex fuel vehicles only.
Yes.
And then we do have a Weights and Measures Division at the Department of Commerce that does do site visits. And
Representative Knuth, do you still have a question?
I do, and I'm going to continue the flipping back and forth between subjects. When you answered Representative Welty's question, you talked about 30 months, but I also know in there's a provision in the Greenhouse Gas Accord, there's a 12-month deadline from the signing, so November 15, 2008, to come back to the states with a model rule drafted. So could you explain to me what is the difference between the 12 and 30-month deadlines and what we can expect?
And please don't say 18 months.
Mr. Chairman, your math is a lot faster than mine. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Knuth, the thinking that went into this resolution last fall was that the states are going to work together to the state executives are going to be working together to put together a plan, a design, a model rule for how they want to proceed together to regionally address greenhouse gas emissions. The goal is to put together that plan, that model rule, by the end of this year. But at the same time, we sort of said that's not the end of it, because each state needs to implement and enact or otherwise put that plan or model rule in place through whatever mechanisms the individual states want to do. So we need to give them time to do that. At the same time, we didn't want to leave that open-ended. And so we sort of said, all right, once you get the model rule, you get 18 months to work it out, because we're all depending on each other to get there.
This general topic is something that I'm sure we'll be returning to, and I think that we should, in the interest of getting at least halfway through the agenda for today, we should continue, Mr. Garvey, with the next items on your agenda.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. That we can sort of whistle through the next items, I hope, relatively quickly. The next item is sort of the reliability administrator. As we sort of established at the outset of my
testimony, I am the acting reliability administrator. We have not found an acceptable candidate to fulfill the duties, but we felt that it was important to proceed with many of the duties and obligations that the law expects of the reliability administrator. So we felt that appointing me acting was the best course of action.
Mr. Garvey, in that regard, not with no reflection on the acting administrator, is it your opinion that the criteria that were established for the reliability administrator are adequate in their present form, or do we need to lower our expectations?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the law was changed in 2007 so that the administrator must have at least 5 years of experience working as a power systems engineer or transmission planner or in a position dealing with power system reliability and may not have been a party or participant in a commission energy proceeding for at least 1 year prior to selection. There aren't that many of those folks to begin with, and there even, and we've identified zero that are willing to come and work for the state pay scale.
That's why I raised the question. I was sort of anticipating that the department would come forward with some recommendation about how to change those criteria that might more realistically coincide with who might be available to take this lousy job. Again, no reflection on the current occupant of the position.
Mr. Chairman, obviously that sort of shows the need for someone good in that position, because the current acting, while desiring to escape, didn't think of that as a solution. But the light bulb did just go off, sir. The efforts that have been going on as acting reliability administrator has been to start putting in motion a number of the studies that the reliability administrator was tasked with, as well as convening a series of technical conferences, with the most recent one being on January 23rd. The reliability administrator, at least as we're seeing it, is primarily a transmission, promoting reliability of the transmission grid. The effort to promote reliability and get more transmission built is a critical component. It is a something that we need across the board. And so we've been sending the message that we need more transmission. And this is more transmission, candidly, members of the committee, beyond the initial phase one of the CapEx 2020 proposal. We need to go beyond those. Beyond that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to sort of turn over to the rest to have Deputy Director Boyle just give you a quick whistle through of the various tasks and reports that we've been doing. You have a document that sort of outlines that report, and he can just sort of go through that as quickly as he can to sort of manage the rest of the time of the hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bull.
I was thinking that it might be easiest to work off of this document, this table that we put together. It's titled 2007 Energy Appropriations and Studies Status Report. It includes things that you've directed us to do and money you've given us to work with, as well as, I won't go into this portion of it so much, but I've also updated you on what energy appropriations and studies that went to other agencies and other folks to work through, just for your reading pleasure. So I'll work through that document. Page two of this document, we've already covered the E85 Everywhere Grant Program, and there's some the information that I've provided there.
Solar PV rebate, as you recall, you appropriated $1 million for the biennium for the solar electric rebate program. That first year funding is completely reserved 6 months into the appropriation. So it shows you, A, that we are correct that there's a lot of interest out there, and B, that we are under estimating the draw on the program.
Before we get too far from the front page, Mr. Boyd, one of the members of the committee who shall remain nameless pointed out that coincidentally MOE is as an acronym for the Minnesota Office of Energy Security happens to be Homer Simpson's favorite hangout. I presume you were aware of that when you chose that name.
We became aware of that after we Edward and I are the schmoes from Moe's now. moving on. You also appropriated on page 3 $1 million, 500 in each year for on-farm biogas recovery capital grant. We've been working with a number of parties in developing the RFP for that for the first year funding on that, and that's ready to be issued early next month. Plug-in hybrids and other on page 4 other automotive technology demonstrations. There's actually quite a bit of work going on with regard to plug-in hybrids in the state. You appropriated $1 million in each year. And you can see on the right-hand column, there's been money going to Minnesota State Mankato to work with Cummings, grant to the state fleet for conversion of three vehicles and testing, working with the green manufacturing study in that regard, and then we're putting out an RFP for the balance of that appropriation.
Mr. Ball, with regard to the grant for state fleet conversion, conversion to what?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. From an electric hybrid vehicle to a plug-in hybrid vehicle. So we'll have some experience within the state fleet on use of plug-in hybrids.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the second one on the second appropriation on page 4 has been somewhat interesting. The electric vehicle demonstration grant, there was $150,000 appropriated for that, for some work to be done on some advanced transmission technologies. We've had some difficulty. The grant recipients are not seeing eye to eye on how to move forward, and so the grant has not yet been issued pending successful negotiations amongst both parties. We can go into more detail, but you probably don't want to know. LIHEAP, there was $1 million in FY 2008 for LIHEAP assistance, supplemental LIHEAP assistance. Most of that went directly to energy assistance, but some did go through the flood relief program for furnace repair.
Mr. Braun, that $173,000 or $174,000 nearly, how was that allocated? Was that just done generally or according to the same principles that presumably we allocate LIHEAP funds in other circumstances?
Ms. Chairman, we allocated a specific set of dollar amounts to the Community Action Program for the Southeast portions of the state that were affected by the floods. We made money available to them with a specific allocation for furnace relief. So the $173,000 was allocated by them to the homes and households whose furnaces were destroyed by the flood.
Without regard to other qualifications?
No, Mr. Chairman. It was completely consistent with their standard operating allocation of eligibility for low-income heating assistance.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in the low-income heating assistance, we have direct payments, we have emergency relief,
we have furnace repair components, and we have weatherization allocations. And so the $107 million that we received this year, we've done an allocation around it. Most of it is heating, direct heating payments, but portions of that fund do go to this kind of thing.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the appropriations for the Clean Energy Resource Team program through the University of Minnesota Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. As you might recall, that these are the folks who work and organize the state into, I think it's six separate teams around the state.
I think it's seven now.
Seven now.
So including the Metro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification. And I was going to point out that the Green Institute was selected as the Metro Area Coordinator for the Metro search. And that activity is ongoing. These folks, I don't know, this might be something that that you folks will hear from over the course of the next year. These clean energy resource teams, it's the first time that we've funded them directly in the budget, and we do appreciate your work on that, Mr. Chairman. They are really doing some incredible outreach work directly with the people who, you know, who are interested in doing the activities and working in partnership with the utility that serves those areas, and it's been a tremendous partnership with CERC. We have an appropriation for a geothermal heat pump evaluation that is ongoing. Contract in place. The contractor's been selected, and the report is due in late March. Page 7, the Renewable Hydrogen Initiative. Appropriation was for $4 million total, with a $600,000 additional for assessment authority. We've issued the biennial report that was required under the statute in 2007, and that contains a recommendation for a set of projects. We'll, it's not specific in terms of what projects, it's the areas of projects that we'll be looking for, and then we'll turn that into an RFP and issue that in March and get some of that money.
And remember that a report, a copy of that report is in your packet.
Mr. Chair, page 8, the Rural Wind, you guys are busy last year. The Rural Wind Revolving Loan Program was a $2 million appropriation for community energy projects to get up and interconnected to the grid. That we're coupling that program with another Rural Wind Assistance Program and working through the Southwest Initiative Foundation and the Seabed Initiative to implement both of those, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. This is Representative Knuth's bill. The Mr. Chair, on page 9, you provided $4.25 million over the biennium for research grants. The first, the RFP for the first round of those grants was issued in January, with proposals due in a couple of weeks, and we'll have a selection by the end of March. You also, on page 10, you also provided money through the Conservation Improvement Program, this is Representative Kalin's bill, providing for research and development grants, and we are working to develop the RFP for those after working with stakeholders and others to put together the structure. We'll be using the RFP in that for that program. Then, Mr. Chair, page 11, we start talking about some of the studies that you've asked for and directed. Page 11, I think, is the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. Page 12, statewide study of dispersed generation potential is a, this is, we often refer to this as the sweet spot study. This is, we've put together, we've asked Matt Scherger, who headed up the wind integration study, if you recall, from that were, it was issued in 2006. Matt is a tremendously talented engineer,
on these, and we were very happy to getting these put together. You assembled a team, a technical review team for the sweet spot study that I think rivals the quality of the wind integration study team, and that work is ongoing. We have another all-day meeting on the 22nd. The first phase of that study report is due in June, so we'll have some information for you then. The Renewable Energy Standard Transmission Study, this was a study that the utilities were responsible for collectively. We used, though, the same technical review team that Matt put together for the sweet spot study. We used for this study as well to help manage the assumptions from both studies. The sweet spot study is looking at capacity at the substation, looking for low voltage, least cost transmission solutions in order to get projects up onto the grid. The Renewable Energy Standard Transmission Study is looking at larger, higher voltage projects and longer term. The utilities did submit their study as part of their biennial transmission report to the commission, and that is under, both of those studies are under review at the Public Utilities Commission currently. Mr. Chair, page 13 is the resource assessment, or what we sometimes refer to as the baseload assessment report. The idea is to look at the electricity needs through 2025, taking into account the energy efficiency and renewable electricity standards that we now have, and our projections for demand growth, and what are the resource needs over this time frame, baseload as well as others. And the report, in the end of session discussion, there wasn't a defined report date, so we're looking to get you something in November prior to next session. Also on page 13, the transmission authority and interconnection evaluations. One was to look at there are a number of states that have state-created transmission authorities that where the state actually directs and owns and bonds for transmission, and the legislature asked us to look at what those transmission authorities have in common, develop, and to see if there's anything that we could do here in the state. If there was some benefit to us doing that. I think the upshot was, the recommendation was that no, that our utilities are working through these issues directly. But we'll get, if folks want copies of any of these reports, we can get those to you as well. The second one, the interconnection evaluation, what this is we're looking at, to give you a little background, there's in the Midwest, the entity that oversees interconnection to the transmission network is the Midwest Independent System Operator, and it is it's a massive operation and covers several states. And in addition to operating the transmission network and planning, working with the utilities to plan the build out of the network, they also are responsible for overseeing interconnections to the network. What we have found is with the passage of the Renewable Electricity Standard and the work that's being done in other states to develop wind resource in the Midwest, MISO has become pretty overwhelmed. I don't think they saw this tidal wave of wind interconnections coming their way, and the backlog for interconnections is huge. So they're working in a number of respects to reform their process to get projects interconnected. But what this study asked us to look at is, what are the possibilities for a state-level interconnection authority to the extent that we could bypass the work that's being done at MISO for interconnection? What could we do as a state in this regard?
Unfortunately, the engineer that we selected, the lawyer engineer that we selected to do the draft on the report, his mother's in intensive care unit, and he's had some issues finalizing the report. But we are working with, in the context of the seabed advisory task force, with a couple of preliminary recommendations. Although we don't have the report to give you, we are working on potential recommendations coming out of the report.
Mr. Bull, I think what we will do, considering that we're beyond our scheduled time, although of course we didn't start in our scheduled time, which we will be doing on Wednesday, by the way, and I think we'll be back in room 200 on Wednesday, Mr. Palmeri. What we'll do is go to the bottom of page 14, and before we get on to the recommendations that don't that are the appropriations rather than our non-MOES appropriations, we'll take that up at the beginning of the meeting on Wednesday. So the sooner we get to the bottom of the page, the sooner we can get out of here, Mr. Bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm done. Just real quickly, we had an off-site renewable distributed generation work group. That the idea here was that we have a lot of programs and policies that provide for interconnected dispersed generation on-site, you know, on your house, on your business. But there are a number of businesses out there and institutions that maybe don't have the resources on site that they would find them to be, you know, to develop those as economic. So they're looking at developing resources off site and getting the power to where they could use it. And we run into difficulty with the exclusive service territories statutes of the utilities. We don't want to get into this retail wheeling sets of issues. And so we worked through a number of issues with this work group and came up with a few recommendations that may be helpful. And that's in that report. We've worked with, on the State Government Energy Savings Plan, we've worked with the University of Minnesota and MINSCU and other state agencies, and are developing a report that you'll be getting on that. There's a need for FIP spending requirements that isn't due until January of 2010. Stay tuned for that. That'll be interesting. And then a pre-buy liquid propane report. It's a requirement for June 30th, and it's not done. That's the end of page 14. I'm back.
Thank you for playing that out. Members, before we wrap up, there are a lot of documents here that will be relevant to the meeting on Wednesday. Since I don't think we have any particular advocates for the paper industry on the committee, could we please see that all of the handouts from today get put back in your packet in the save section so that we don't have to reproduce all of those 2 days from now. And pages, would you please perform that function for the people that have already left? I think we do have a couple of questions. Representative Rude, Representative Wagenius, did you want to touch on anything? All right. Well, we do have another committee scheduled for this room for 4 o'clock, so anything that remains, the members, you might want to look over some of these documents that you haven't seen before. And we will resume this hearing on Wednesday. Gentlemen, thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.